Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Fundraising Masters for September. I'm delighted today to have Larry Johnson here to talk about what's holding you back and to help you get over those things that are holding you back from raising all the money you need to fulfill your organization's mission, see its vision through, and make the biggest impact you can. I'm Brian Saber. I'm the president of Asking Matters. For those of you who are new to Fundraising Masters, it's one of the free programs, services we provide at Asking Matters to bring you a wide range of voices in our wonderful nonprofit field, specifically in fundraising, with a big emphasis on asking face-to-face and what's stopping us. I've been asking face-to-face my whole life. Larry has done a tremendous amount of asking himself, and we are a mutual admiration society, so I was delighted to have him on here today. Some quick housekeeping, and then I'm going to turn it over to Larry. And that is that I hope you are seeing a control panel and a slide. If not, click on that orange and white arrow to expand the control panel box. Two things to look out for. One, audio. If you're having problems listening, most of us listen over our computers today, you can toggle to phone call and get a number to call in on. That usually clears the line. Usually it is on your end. Once in a while, it's on GoToWebinar's end. Second is the questions box. Larry will be asking you questions as we go along. You are encouraged to ask your questions. Larry will ask me what's doing in the questions box from time to time, and I will share those questions with him. We'll also have some time, a nice chunk of time at the end. So be sure to ask those questions. And to make sure you know where the questions box is, can you type in where you are listening in from today? With all this virtual technology, it's also nice to know. And I am speaking to you today, actually not from South Orange, New Jersey, where I live and work, but from Princeton, New Jersey. My son is a freshman at Westminster Choir College, which is fighting this huge battle to survive. And I came down to do some protests and am doing this from my son's dorm room. And he wasn't expecting me, so it's quite interesting here. Last time he was, and it was much cleaner. Anyway, that's where I am today. Great to have you from all over: Arkansas, Cleveland, San Francisco, Detroit, Colorado, St. Augustine, Minnesota, Phoenix, Allentown. I love having you all from all over, and that we can be here together. Switzerland, Ro King from Switzerland. We have Sherry from Ottawa. Wonderful. Thank you all. We will be giving you a PDF of these slides that will come either later today or tomorrow with a link to the recording so you can hear it again. You can pass it on to others on your team. And I think that's it for housekeeping and me. So I am going to introduce Larry very briefly. I don't want to take his time, and he'll have lots of stories to share that'll help you get him to know him better. But he is an author, coach, and trainer. He's written this amazing book, The Eight Principles, which he's going to talk about and which I'll remind you about tomorrow as well. I've read it. It's really an important book in the field in giving us a different perspective in terms of our work, in terms of donors, in terms of how to make the impact. Larry, I'm delighted to have you here today. Can we hear you? Let's see.
I hope so. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Okay, great. So thank you again. And I'm going to change presenters and give you the floor. Here we go. One sec. Okay, Larry, you are on and you should have the screen.
All right, there we go.
There you
All
go.
Right. Well, I'm sorry I'm not as good looking as Brian. He's a lot more hair than I am, but you know. Anyway, he's a great guy. Anyway, even though he is better looking than I am. All right, we'll get over that.
Please.
All right. Well, you know, hey, you know, what can I say?
Okay, I'll take it. I'll take it. Go
you,
on.
You take it. Yeah, see, and that's, by the way, that's a good lesson. A lot of people are very good at giving. They're not very good at receiving. Mm-hmm. That's important. You know, and as we get started, that's one of the skills that people who are in our field need to cultivate. And that's not just receiving a gift. It's receiving anything that's offered to you by someone else. A compliment, for instance. Or when you go into a meeting and someone offers you a drink or something, you know, if they're offering you something, it's their attempt to be hospitable and to reach out to you. And it's really almost, in the old days, it was obligatory to accept that and say thank you. And that sets the tone that you accept them on equal terms. And that's sort of what we're talking about today. So that was, hey, thank you, Brian. I like that. So what's holding you back? We're going to be talking about some things that I believe are probably keeping you from your full potential in terms of what you can raise. I'm just going to put it on the table right now. There is no fixed amount of philanthropy out there. It is an elastic number. And how much is available every year is dependent on one variable. And this has been done at Boston College several years ago. And that is simply the degree of engagement by the donor. So you can put up the notion that there's too much competition and too few funds out of your head. And if you have any problems with that assertion, I'll take you on. So, and I can show you the details. So, but let's look to the money. Let's assume that the money out there is available to you. It is available. The key is, how do you get over the fact that there's some things that are keeping you from jumping off that cliff like that? Well, the first question I would like to ask everyone, do you believe your organization is financially secure? Just a yes or no in the question box. You can interpret secure any way you want to. I'll define it in a couple of minutes.
Okay, so far we are running 50-50 yes and no.
All right, okay.
50-50, mate, let's see. We've got a not completely, but I'd say about 50-50, and so far I'm seeing 75 responses.
All right, great. Okay, next question, and I ask this quite seriously. Are you seriously interested in changing what's not working? And what I mean by that is changing what's not working in the way you're approaching your work, changing what's not working because of the perspective you or your organization may have, or any other obstacles. Are you seriously interested in making a change so that you can do better?
And they're absolutely, yes, we are. Joe Allen says absolutely yes. So they're with you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm going to hold you to that. So then, what is holding nonprofits back? We're going to talk about some of the common things. The first one is they're stuck in what they're already doing. Oh, well, this is the way we've always done it. Oh, we're different here. I just heard that 2 weeks ago. I wanted to scream when someone says that to me. These are mature people who are reasonably intelligent, and yet they act as though they're another species other than Homo sapien, and that they're somewhere other than planet Earth. So they're very reluctant to make changes. Any of your organizations feel like you're stuck, that you're just doing stuff because it's what's comfortable, it's what you've always done?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Ken says no, good for you.
All right, good. Well, Ken, we're gonna be talking about some new things you can do. All right, they're also hooked on short-term cash. Now, let me define short-term cash. Short-term cash is any money that you would have to have within 120 days or your organization would enter insolvency, meaning you couldn't pay your bills or make your payroll at some level. That's short-term cash, 120 days, all right? How many out there feel that you're under that threshold of 120 days of having that kind of cash on hand?
You know, Larry, while they are typing that in, I will share that I became executive director of an organization in New York about 13 years ago now. We had a $180,000 biweekly payroll. And on my first day, I found out we had $20,000 in the bank, and payroll was 3 days later. And oops. We had out of $1.2 million in non-personnel, we had $1 million in payables, meaning 10 plus months of payables. So crazy.
Uh-huh.
Right? Crazy. Well, how can you operate? How can you possibly operate with that?
Well, and you know, apparently almost 40% of the nonprofits do operate with less than 120 days of cash. in this country,
Amazing.
Which is scary. Any business would be, any business owner would be, you know, would be biting his fingernails. Any stockholders would be extremely nervous because that really isn't a place to be. And good news is you don't have to be on in this place. You can be as secure as anyone else in that regard. How many out there have ever had the experience of someone in your organization expecting a silver bullet, Clark Kent, to arrive? And for those of you who don't know, Clark Kent is, he is Superman. I mean, who expect, you know, something like that just to come out of the blue and solve all your problems? Anyone had that? Brian, you seeing anything?
Yes, yes, totally. Yes, definitely. Yes, yes. A few no's, but lots of yeses.
All right. Well, let me give you a clue as to how you know that you're being pitched a silver bullet. Okay. Whenever the pitch starts with this many tips, this many tricks, or a secret, you can stop listening because that is a silver bullet. And what it may do is give you some sort of short-term injection of something, but it's not going to solve your problems. In fact, you'll probably be in worse shape afterwards. I'd like to ask the group, what are, very simply, three mistakes that you think you or your organization have made in the last year vis-a-vis fundraising?
Wow, three mistakes. How about at least type one of them in?
Yeah,
one
come
mistake
on.
You think you've let's made.
Let's be honest, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes. So
remember,
let's see. Not knowing how much to ask for, not keeping donors informed enough, focusing on not income generating activities, not asking, she said, not knowing my donors well enough, not stewarding them well, not asking enough, poor record keeping, relying on a windfall, getting bogged down in administration, too many events. Ah, Robert, that's music to my ears. Too many events, poor donor communication, not finding more prospective donors, waiting too long to ask, not building a pipeline, undershooting the ask, procrastinating in meetings with donors, spending capital cash without enough general operating support coming in. Communications about impact, not asking for enough, too event focused, another one Ron says. We're getting lots of not asking enough or not asking for too much, some poor board support, not stockpiling income for lean months. I like the way Sharon put that. Board and C-level thinking it's an easy thing to do, right? That's your silver bullet you talk about, right? Too many other demands, poor board support, so forth. We get
okay.
Great. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. All right. Let's think about what sort of how those problems have been sort of verbalized. You know, Brian's shtick is teaching you how to ask and how to ask effectively, and he does it very well. But as Brian would tell you, unless there's a context to this ask, chances of it being successful go way down. So, because what he's not doing is teaching you how to hypnotize your prospective investors or how to hex them or to put a spell on them that takes their free will away, all right, he's teaching you how to reach out to these people in a meaningful way so that they will hopefully invest in your organization or better, your cause or your vision, you see. But without context, it's hard to be able to do that. So, what nonprofits are often doing is they're what I call putting the cart before the horse. And the way they're doing it is as follows. Believe it or not, there are some principles that govern philanthropy. And I'm using the word philanthropy on purpose because if we had a longer time, we would discuss how that philanthropy and fundraising are really mirror images of each other. That's very important to understand. They're just simply flip sides of the same coin. And so they have to merge together. So many people either don't know that they're principles or don't know what they are, all right? And most people have some idea of the particular nature of their organization, a paradigm. This is what does change. You know, the whys are different from the orchestras or the art museums are different from the environmental people. All the paradigms are different. The worldviews are different, but principles govern everything. They're over everything. I had an individual say to me a week ago that he didn't think principles were over everything. That's the definition of one. That's the definition of a principle. It applies everywhere, all the time. And what you need to do is learn what they are so that you can filter those through your particular situation. And after you've done that, then you can begin to choose your methods, the ones that work for you. This is very critical. Methods or process are situational. What works in one place won't necessarily work in another place. And yet, how many of you out there have ever succumbed to the, well, we saw it work over here at organization X, so we're going to try the same technique over here at our organization? How many of you have ever succumbed to that?
Did you want to type it in?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Just remind them to do that when you ask.
All right. So, see, that's what I'm talking about, is that process is situational. It may or it may not work in your particular situation because your paradigm is going to be different from another organization. So that's why it's so important to know what the principles are. Now, you know, what are the eight principles? Well, you know, these are not anything that I dreamed up or I created. I put names to them. You know, where I wrote the book, I put names to them, and they're based on the experience of my own experience and the experience of others. But they are the universal natural laws of philanthropy. And once you know what they are, you can take that and compare them to any high performing nonprofit. When I say high performing, I mean raising more money this year than last year and having a very economically resistant revenue stream philanthropically. That to me is a successful fundraising program. You're going to see that they follow these very closely, even if they don't know they are, because they're principles and they act all the time. Let's just run through them real quickly. We can't get into any detail today, but I'm just going to kind of give you a taste of what we're talking about. The first one is principle one, donors are the drivers. This is perhaps one of the fundamental principle. Donors are the ones that are in the driver's seat. Your organization is not, I'm sorry to say. They are driving the philanthropic engine. But here's the remarkable thing. They aren't driving it with their money. No. You see, this is what happens when fundraisers make it all about money, because it's not. True philanthropy, engaging philanthropic investors, they're investing in your organization for a return. But unlike in the commercial sense, where their return is financial, their return is intangible, but far more important to them, because they're looking for their visions, their values, even self-actualization to be fulfilled. That's what they're looking for. So this is one reason right here why transactional methods, i.e. events that are revenue generating with auctions and that sort of thing, are so damaging, because you aren't appealing to people in a way that it will really connect with them. And you've already, by the virtue of the fact of the way you've designed it, you've kept giving at a pretty low level. And when I say low level, probably $5,000 or under for most cases, you see. And these things are not renewable because they don't engage people at the heart level. And it's what Seth Godin would say, they're corruptive in that they give people the impression they're being philanthropic when they are not. So principle one is donors are the drivers. They're driving this train. Principle two is begin at the beginning. You must frame your outreach to your potential investors, and I use that word deliberately, in terms and ways that they will understand. I can't tell you the number of nonprofit websites that I go to and they read like government forms or tax submissions, or, you know, filled full of jargon. That's so off-putting to donors. They just keep looking. Or the other thing is, I have younger people working for me, quite a bit younger in some cases, and I asked one of them once, so what happens when you come to a website that doesn't mobily adapt? And she said, oh, I just keep looking. About 40% of nonprofit websites still do not mobily adapt, and that means that it doesn't rearrange itself so that you can read it on a phone. Instead, it just compresses it down and you can't read it. So, and the other thing here is, it's important to realize that however important and urgent and worthy your cause is, and no one's discussing that, no one's disputing that, It is just not about you or your cause. It's about engaging potential investors in a way that they will want to invest for their own reasons, which in turn does provide a conduit of revenue to fulfill the vision and mission that you're working on. That's very important. Principle three is leadership leads. You know, executives, board, governing boards, they dominate and control the process, whether they think they do or they don't, because their behavior and their actions, the way the program is constructed, the way it's resourced, their philosophy, whether they give or not, all of this leads the organization in a certain direction. And that's either a good direction or a not so good direction. But they're the ones that are controlling this. Principle four is learn and plan. Before going out and asking anybody for a dime, you really need to learn who the people are or the kinds of people that would normally and naturally support you by either their personal affinity or by their proximity. Too often, the first thing we do is go out and just solicit anybody that we can get a name to and just hope and see what comes in. You know, that is not an effective way of raising money. It is not a way of building a sustainable program that will be economic, that will be recession resistant. Principle five is work from the inside out. Here again, Bill, Sally, I know this rich person out there and they like our stuff, but they're way out there. We've never met them. We don't know who the heck they are, but we've seen them in the newspaper. Let's go ask them. No. You work from the inside out. You start from the people that you know already, from the networks you have. This is why boards are so important. You build out from that. And sooner or later, you may get a connection to Bill. But you wait until you have that connection. Work from the inside out. Principle six is divide and grow. This essentially is the principle of treating different donors differently. All right, everyone is not the same. And I don't mean just in giving ability. I mean in terms of their age, their position in life, their relationship to you. All of these things are different. And so the programs that really scale, that really grow over time, are the ones that have learned to do this and do it well. And there are different ways we can talk about how you do that. Principle seven is renew and refresh. First, before you go out and ask for any new donors, work on renewing the ones you already have. That's the sustainability piece. You know, I'm into sustainable and scalable fundraising. That's what I do. So sustainable, you must renew the ones you already have. I think the overall first year donor renewal rate is about, 40%, just under that. That's pathetic when you consider that the consumer products 1 year renewal rate is 95%. Think about it. People are more loyal to their toothpaste than they are their charity. And why is that? Well, almost always it's because charities simply aren't engaging them. And the only time they hear from them is when they're asking for money. I was with a philanthropist a couple of weeks ago, and I heard that over and over and over again. You know, well, I got this call today from the XYZ. He wants to have our annual luncheon to hit me up for money. I never hear anything else during the year, but I know what he wants. That's so off-putting. And lastly, principle eight, invest, integrate, and evaluate. You have to invest in a fundraising program. That's people, money, it has to go in. I mean, there are lots of barometers and benchmarks for keeping costs under control. But one of the things that nonprofits, especially smaller ones, one of their mistakes is they consider the money they put into their fundraising program identical with all their structural expenses. It's the equivalent of the light bill, the power bill. It's not. That's an expense. You must have that to operate. Anything that you're spending on fundraising should and return more than you're spending. And that should be tracked very closely. So when you start tracking that event you're so in love with and you realize that it's costing you 50 to 75% of every dollar you raise, you're going, oops, what am I doing? As opposed to building a program that has a pipeline that moves people in the right direction over time that costs you 20 cents on the dollar. There you go. You must integrate everything that you do. You can't have random appeals for this, that, or the other. I mean, you know, secondary schools are notorious for this. They absolutely browbeat and nickel and dime parents to death. There's this fund and that fund and the other fund. That really wears people down. That is the number one negative in all the donor surveys, being asked too often and in a disjointed way. And then thirdly, evaluate every single year, evaluating how effective these programs were, making adjustments to them, adding new ones, deleting others. This is what I'm talking about here. So What is an outcome, and this is a question I'd like, that you've abandoned because of an unreasonable time frame or lack of consistency? What I mean by that is, you set out to do something and people became impatient for it to pay off, or you didn't do it consistently over time for it to pay off. Give me a couple of examples of that. I mean, I could name some, but I'd like it to come from the audience.
Let's see. Summer appeal newsletter, monthly giving program. So far we've got a board education rating and screenings. What else have you abandoned? A young patrons program, wow, which seems very important. Mm-hmm. We're going to have future donors. An employee campaign, Deborah says. What else? What else have you abandoned? Give them a few. Okay, here comes some more. Okay, a business partner sponsorships, Jen says. A founder's reception near Christmas to thank supporters. Ken adds, emerging leaders. Teresa talks about corporate sponsorship, events, board involvement in fundraising. The organization I work for, smile, CFC programs. I'm not sure what those are, Christopher. That might just be me. CFC, Center for Something, maybe. CEO stopped asking his pipeline. Giving Tuesday, keeping donors engaged and informed via donor newsletter, meetings, one-on-one, phone-a-thon, just to say thank you or with one or two updates. A combined federal campaign, federal employee giving, that's the second one. Combined federal campaign is CFS. Volunteer recognition luncheon, Giving Tuesday, Carol says. Hello, Carol. Lots of things have gone
right.
The way and more coming in.
When you embark upon something new, there needs to be an understanding of the time frame that's required to show results and what those results are going to be. That can be quantified. And oftentimes organizations kind of launch into these things because it sounds like a good idea or it gives warm feelings. And so there's not any real understanding of what the value added is or what the outcomes are supposed to be. They aren't defined clearly. And then also there's not a time frame that's given to expect the results. And of course, without consistency, it's like exercise. You know, well, I went to the gym once last month. Why haven't I lost my love handles? Well, hello. Okay. Now, a lot of these that I heard have something to do with the relationship with those that support you, whether it's asking, rewarding, communicating, all those things. And so what I'm going to suggest to you that probably the principal thing that's holding you back is that there needs to be a fundamentally different understanding of the relationship that you have with your investors. This is the picture I was thinking of when we talked about philanthropy and fundraising being the mirror image of each other. They're really the same thing, but they're flip sides. So let's talk a little bit about what philanthropy actually is. Can anyone tell me the country those emails, those windmills are in? Emails, windmills, just put the country in if you know what it is. Make a guess.
Let's see. Holland, Greece, Denmark, Greece, Holland, Africa, Greece.
All right. Well, the Greeces have it.
Those are okay.
Okay. And there's a reason why they're Grecian. Because the word philanthropy has as its roots two Greek words. The word philios, which is a verb that means brotherly love, and the word anthropos, which is a noun, which means mankind. So you put those two things together and you have brotherly love and mankind. You put the word together, philanthropy. So what does philanthropy mean? It means for the love of humankind. Anyone see the word money in there? No, because it's not about money. That's the whole point. Money is involved, to be sure. It's not irrelevant. But that isn't the focus, and it sure as heck isn't the focus of donors. That's not where they want to be, because if you've engaged the donor appropriately, the donor will gladly give at a capacity level, whether that's 20 bucks or 20 million bucks. It doesn't matter. You want to move donors to their capacity. And the way to do that is to engage them with what's really important to them. And the money is a part of that, but it's not their focus. So what do investors want their philanthropy to be? Well, that's a rhetorical question. It's got to be meaningful to them. It's not about us, no matter how meaningful we think what we're doing is. It has to achieve their goals. And in order for us to position it that way, we have to know what their goals are. You know, everyone isn't going to support you. Get over it, which actually makes your job easier because you don't have to appeal to everyone. That's why the whole idea of competition is kind of a myth, because who supports you if you're approaching them in the right way won't necessarily support anyone else or something that's radically different. It creates full impact, their impact. I can tell you right now, having worked with donors in my career, I'm just with several, what, a couple of weeks ago, this is what a lot of donors feel like when they make gifts. It's like they're burning money. They get nothing for it, nothing. Oh, they may get a trinket if they got a discount, but that's not a donor, that's a responder, you know? So why are they feeling like this? Well, I can tell you that so much fundraising is organizationally focused. It's focused about our needs and what we're trying to accomplish in the world, however worthy or well motivated, all right? It's transactional. You give us this, we give you that. This is one reason why it's non-responsive. What did I talk about the other day? Just a few minutes ago, excuse me. The only time you hear from someone is when they're asking you for money. Remember that your donors or your investors only know what they receive from you. They don't understand anything that's going on inside. Then there's the whole idea of plaintiff. You know, oh, we really need this money. Oh, this is so urgent. You know, this is the proverbial put the starving child on the poster approach. You know, guilt only accomplishes so much, all right? What are three bad habits you currently tolerate or you think you tolerate that are undermining your results? Let's get some answers there. That you tolerate. You know they're bad habits, but you're tolerating them anyway.
Let's see what people have to say. Okay, three bad habits. Here we go. Don't stick to my prioritization. Not calling on a regular basis, lack of board member involvement, not enough research prior to donor meetings, no focus on one program all over the map, procrastination, poor turnaround times and acknowledgments and such, reaching out only to ask for money, not reporting often enough to donors, lack of board involvement. We often talk about how our students are so needy, board members avoiding donor meetings because they don't know what to say, not having a formal process for donor stewardship, board not involved, board members expecting a staff person to carry the load, speaking, writing like a fundraiser, not a donor, lack of leadership. We're getting tons of them.
All right. Okay, there you go. The one about the board, you know, a lot of executives are very reluctant to give boards real training or coaching in this area. They think, oh, well, they don't really need them or they don't want it. Well, the surveys say differently. You know, only about 20 to 25% of donors actually get any kind of training. I mean, any kind, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. And about 70 to 75% of them would like some. So there you go. Let's focus on what we're trying to achieve, the result we're trying to achieve. And that, oddly enough, is the joy to the investor, number one. That's what they're looking for, and the joy to you. Brian and I were having this discussion before the session started about, you know, fundraising should be fun. And I don't mean in the, you know, beer blast, raucous kind of fun, let's have some fun, but it's the deep abiding joy of being able to connect people who are well motivated with a worthy cause. That's a wonderful feeling. I mean, I've had that opportunity, and it just is, there's nothing like it when you're helping people realize their dreams and at the same time, they're funding something that's truly, truly worthy. you see. But in order to make that happen, the focus can't be where it usually is. You know, at the beginning, there's philanthropy. Philanthropy is what fuels these other things. It's for the love of men, of humankind. Then there's the nonprofit. The nonprofit really is not a destination. It is a facilitating organization. It's a conduit. That's all it is. You know, let's not get too impressed with ourselves. And then lastly, it's the community that benefits from the philanthropy, however you want to define that word, community. So you put these things together, and if they're in the right balance, what you get is something I call the triple win. That's the key. But too often, we don't see something that's triangular like this. We see something that's linear, where the nonprofit goes out and extracts funds from a philanthropic source and turns around and then gives the money to the community. So it's linear. It's not a cooperative venture. It's not an understanding that the philanthropist have an integral role to play far beyond simply providing financial resources. First, and fundraising is first and foremost a form of service. You are serving the donors. You are serving the investors. Those are the people you should be focused on. You should adopt the mindset of a wealth manager. You want something that is best for them. It announces our vision and invites others to participate. Seth Godin is the creator of what's known as permission marketing. Those some of you may know or may not know of him, but he's asked once, well, why would someone give $100,000 to a charity? And his response, oh, they think it's a bargain. They think it's worth $150,000. Because you see, there again, they're getting something intangible that to them is worth far more than money. I went backwards on that, sorry. Vision brings together the needs and resources to meet those needs, okay? Vision brings needs and resources together, but they act in concert to each other. It is the opposite of begging. I can't tell you how, you know, you don't ever have to go, oh, will you please do this? Will you just give me whatever, you know? How many times do you get the kids at your door? Will you just give me $5? I had my neighbor a few years ago. He's since grown and he's in Stanford now. He's a very bright kid. And he used to come over to sell stuff for his school. And he approached me once, a candy bar. I can't remember what it was. And Henry asked me if I'd buy his candy bar. And I said, well, no, but I'll write you a check for $50. His response, well, I don't know if I can accept that. I said, all right, Henry, you go home and talk to your dad and then come back. Well, he was back within the hour. And his dad told me later, he said, you better get over there before Larry changes his mind now. And that he didn't understand that he could ask for something and expect me to support it because I believed in it. Properly approached, you're inviting someone, not really, to invest their resources. And when you really, really, really get this, and when I say you, I mean the institutional you, not you, the particular you, your board, your executive, everyone that's in your organization, when they really get this, then fundraising, a lot of the fear of it really evaporates. It goes away because then you're not seen as someone who's taking something that or manipulating someone to give you something they really don't want to give you. You see, that's what the root of most of the fear is. So when we seek with the mind of blessing, we want to bless other people. We want to make life better for them. We offer something of far greater value than for which we're asking. Think about that. It's a lot more than the money they're giving you. I mean, you know, I've worked with organizations where a donor would express an interest in a particular project, and then the immediate response of the organization is to lowball the number on the donor, and because they think it's about money, and it's not a number that would effectively create the outcome that the donor is suggesting that they want to create. So when they present something like that, they're very likely to get a no, because the donor who's pretty well informed and pretty intelligent at that level is going to say, well, this isn't going to do the job. What? I mean, you know, do I want to invest in you if this is what you come back to me with? There you go. So do you believe, after we've been through all of this, that there are sufficient philanthropic resources out there that are available to you? Not that you get them, but they are available to you. A yes, sir, or no?
Lots of yeses, yes, 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 yes,
Okay.
Yes, however, not in our current pipeline. Right. But yes.
Yeah, I didn't say you had them in, I didn't say you had
Right.
them in the fold. I said they're out there. The
Right.
resources are there. They're
One
available.
maybe. One maybe.
Well, maybe. Okay. We've got a holdout. Well, offline we can have an email or a conversation, and I'll show you where they are available. All right. Well, I can assure you that they are. All right. In my career, which has been, longer than I'd like to admit, is the obstacles to raising money, the ones that you can't get around, are never on the outside of an organization. That's never what the problem is. I mean, I had someone tell me, I was in Midwest, Rust Belt City, a week ago, and they said, "Oh, this isn't any money in this town." I beg your pardon. I was just at a breakfast where there was all kinds of money. All right, you're just not making outreach to people in a way that you get the response that you're looking for. There's all kinds of money in this town. For those of you who work in small, or whether it's small, large, or whatever, if you want to know, if you want to have a sense of how much money is in a town, like I live in a town of 40,000 people, and if you looked at it, you might think, "Well, there's not much money here." Okay. There are six banks and five senior brokerages in this town. Do you think there's money here? You see? So when you look at a town, if you just want to get an idea, count the number of banks in town, count the number of brokerages in town. That will tell you how much money is there. Even if you don't see a lot of Lamborghinis on the street or a lot of high-end $2,000 or $5,000 suits people are wearing. All right. There's the key. Look beyond the obvious. So I'm going to show you now a way that I help people create a new relationship between giver and receiver. We're going to talk about what I specifically do here. All right. First, I say you got to learn the eight principles, then you choose your methods. That's the case in life wherever. You got to learn if you're looking at physics or chemistry, you got to learn the principles of physics and chemistry before you can start putting an experiment together. All right. And let's talk about how I think you learn and apply the eight principles. This is how I do it. Well, we have an online program for those who want it. It's kind of individual. It's based on sort of learning it yourself. What we really like to do is start and give people context and then let them experience it in a live way. And then also then give it to them, put it inside their organization. That's really the way we do it. And we call it the Eight Principles Tool Chest. And the way we do it is very simple. We believe in simplicity. We do not use jargon. We do not make it overly complicated. We believe that the best thing to do is to keep the sophistication but make it simple. It's like Apple Computer, for those of you who are Apple enthusiasts, all the complexities behind the screen. This is why it makes it so useful for people who aren't professional fundraisers. Go to a board meeting and start talking live on sign button, see how many eye rolls and glaze overs you get. All right. The same thing with executives. They're not interested in that. That's not really where they want to go. They want to understand it in a simple way. It's got to be practical, actionable. Yeah, we've been talking about principles, but there are specific actions and practices you can do. And then it ought to be, there again, there's that word again, joy. It ought to be fun. It ought to be enjoyable to other people. It shouldn't be agony. This is one of the reasons why boards, you say fundraising and they're all heading for the exits because they see this vision of having to go in, with no clothes on, essentially, no mental clothes on, and they're going in and they're trying to get a gift for something they don't understand to a person they don't know or understand. That's where so much of this fear comes from. So the way we put it together is what I've just been saying. Get context. That's the Four Corners profile. It's a 30-minute thing. It's based on the Boston Consulting Group model. It's geared for board chairs and executives, not for professionals. I can't tell you, most people think they're in one position, but they're really in another position. But once you know where you really are, then getting to where you want to go becomes a lot easier. It's like MapQuest, that you'll never get a destination direction till you put in the origin direction, the origin location. That's it. And then more often than not, it's not so much skill-based, but it's attitudinal-based that we have to address. And therefore, we've created about four live interactive workshops that address the whole idea of what I've been talking about, shifting this paradigm, this understanding of what fundraising is all about. And there again, this is geared to boards. It's geared to professionals. We have a university that uses it for new gift officers. We have, a health system that uses it for everybody, for their boards especially. And these are interactive things. These aren't your sitting in a conference for 3 hours in a seat looking at slides. No, third person teaching, live role play, media base, this kind of thing. And then each one of these has an accountability piece that, oh no, you just don't get out of here and say that that was nice, but you create a plan that you adhere to. But then the thing that I think is so is for me is a fundraiser. And this is what I learned when I became a Covey facilitator is the only thing that makes it permanent is when you bring it inside the organization. And when I was a Covey facilitator and I worked for SUNY, State University of New York, I really liked his material for working with leadership with our staffs. And so I became a facilitator and I got a license from Covey and we put it inside. So they didn't have to go to a conference to get a fresh hit. They didn't have to bring in a consultant for the umpteenth time. It was something that we could own and do over and over again, which is very easy to do. And that way, when we had board chair changes or other staff changes, we kept our culture. You know, I had wonderful clients who paid me very nice fees to come in and help them make good progress. And 2 years later, what are they doing? Back to the same old stuff. So there's four corners. That's what it looks like. Gets leadership's attention, provides clarity. That's what a report looks like. Very simple. There's the curriculum. As I said, using adult learning methods. This is not going back to kindergarten or sitting in a conference session. And then the accountability piece, the participants' development for themselves, they implement it, keeps the advisor involved. They're working with someone on the outside. And then the embed piece is they license it themselves and it enables them to create a stable culture. And that's the way I do what I do. But how much would you like to increase your sustained revenue by? Choose a number. Choose numbers that aren't on there. Let's see. How much would you like to increase your sustained annual revenue? That means what you get this year is what you get next year and what you get the year after with increments. Give me a number. What percentage points?
Okay, let's see. 450%, Ken says. That's very specific. 50, 200, 300, 300, 150, 100, 250, 200. Realistic 100, Carol says. From 10 to 100. 1,000%, Tiffany says. Wow. 150. So we've got a lot in the 2 to 300 range. Interesting. 2 to 300.
Right. Well, I'm going to show you some verified numbers here. Now, this is based on research that was done at Texas Tech using 200,000 nonprofits over a 5-year period. And naturally, I branded it to myself because that's what I do. But here's what they did. The organizations that you see those red gains, those 5-year gains, they created a path, I don't say pipeline, a path to engage their donors in the ways that I've just described. That's what they did. And these are the results they got. And as you can see, if you're a small organization, you can get a 400% increase in 5 years. And then it keeps going after this. And the blue boxes, and of course, the gains were the 3 to 5 and the 5 to 10 are very small. They didn't show up on the scale, but there is some gain there. The blue box is what you'd normally get using a conventional cash approach, just kind of bumbling along and hoping for the best. And that even includes major gifts management stuff. The key here is building a path that engages donors and brings them closer to you over time. That's the key. Now, you remember I asked the question about time frame and consistency. These are not just add water. All right. This is a 5-year game. So that in the first year, you'll see virtually none of this. In the second year, you'll see about 20% of that bar. The third year, you'll see 60% of that bar. The fourth year, you'll see 80%. In the fifth year, you'll get the full gain. That's the way it goes. It's parabolic. It's not linear. And this is what's so important is you must have the focus, the staying power, and the decision to make this happen. It's not going to be a once and done thing. And that's what screws up so many organizations. They're going for the tips, techniques, and secrets. All right. So then success is never a one-time effort. Never. It's a way of life. It's the way we do business. It's one of the reasons why we license it to the inside organizations, because it's, oh, this is the way we do business here. This is the way we think about this. This is our philosophy. This is our approach. So, you know, for those of you who want to do this, the time now is to get started. You know, go out there and do something. You know, that's the website. you know, if you want to email me, you can email info@theaprinciples.com. We have some free resources that we can send you to kind of give you more ideas of what this is about, give you more ideas. If someone wants to email me and request a consultation, hey, the first one's complimentary. I'd love to talk to you. But I want to open it now to questions, because I'm sure there's some out there, and I'd like to see what they are.
Okay, let's see. Jen was the first one to say consultation, yes. So if you end up lining up a bunch of these, just remember Jen asked first.
I will.
And she's been, and she has been a great contributor throughout your webinar, answering all the questions. So
she's at the top of the list, Jen. You just give me an email, and we'll get it set up. I love, by the way, the audience, I love Zoom. I like to see people's faces. That's important. I'm a face-to-face guy.
So so here we've got some coming in. First, we have an annual auction event. Is it a bad idea to do that? Tammy asks.
Well, that's a pretty open-ended question, and I could give you an open-ended flat answer, but let me give you something a little more nuanced. I presume when you say that, that you mean that you're selling discounted stuff to raise money. That's what I presume. Okay, the only way a direct auction like that really works is in maybe two or three or a handful of venues in the country where it's not about the stuff. For instance, you know, I live in the Rockies. Well, down the road for me, is Aspen. You know, that's Disneyland. That's where they'll offer something that has a retail value of $5,000 and the first bid is $100, because it isn't about the stuff. It's about the one-upsmanship with your neighbor down the road. And that's the difference. But generally speaking, those are losers. They're losers two ways. They don't generate any loyalty. They raise money at a low level, and they're extremely costly. They raise some cash, but they're 50 to 75 cents on the dollar. And if you start including staff time that could be reallocated in a more productive way, and you see what that costs you, well, then you're really in the hole. Now, that is not to say that you can't have an event that isn't fun. And when people are hooked on this stuff, I call it the crack cocaine of fundraising, when they're hooked on this, there's a way to kind of move that in another direction slowly, because people are very emotionally committed to these things. And you start, you know, I was actually at a college that did one of these, and I was stunned when I got there going, you're still doing this stuff? And I said to the president when I first arrived, I'm going to give this thing a decent burial. And he said, well, you try. I almost lost my job when I did it. So people are very committed to this stuff. And I would say that a half step that will help you is to get rid of the stuff and do what's commonly called an inverse auction or reverse auction, where you're asking for money directly. You're not asking for, you're not selling stuff. And the way you do that is you figure out the kind of the capacity of your audience. It takes some work at the front end. You come up with a giving pyramid, and then let's say the top gift you think is going to be 10 grand, because there is a limit to what people will write you as a check that evening. All right, and then maybe it's higher, but anyway. And then at each of those levels, you in advance you get a straight person, a straight man in the audience that you've approached in advance. And you said, Sally, would you do this? Would you pledge $10,000 when it comes up? And if she says yes, okay, you're golden. So what that does is, you know, you start the bidding at 10 and Sally says, I'll do this. Well, then it starts the ball rolling. That's a way to generate revenue and to begin to show leadership that there's much more out there than you might think, number one. And number two, you don't have to give a quid pro quo to get money. And that begins that process. And ultimately, what you want to do is get to the point where you're not even generating any revenue at all, unless it just happens to be one of those venues that people love this kind of thing, because you want that renewability. You want what gives you the sustainability and the real growth is the fact that these people are emotionally connected to you. And that so, and by the way, organizations that had that kind of fundraising back in the last recession, they experienced a maximum of a 1% downturn in their fundraising. Think about that, 1%. Now, for those who are really hooked on the short-term cash and the events, in my area, they saw 50, 60, 70% drops, even in a wealthy community like Sun Valley. Because there's one organization that was my client. They had one huge event that generated $6 million a year. They saw that absolutely evaporate when the stock market crashed. And because these people, I mean, how many $2,000 bottles of wine are you going to buy? when your stock market portfolio went down. Not many, because that's discretionary income. All right, that's my answer. I hope that was something. What's next?
Okay. How about what are some examples of beginning at the beginning for principle two?
All right. Let me see if I can phrase something here. A begin at the beginning would be, you know, Mr. Donor, I know how important it is for you that you see that the community is, I'll give you a better example. I'll give you an example, a known example of a donor that I actually saw 2 weeks ago. His number one concern in his market is getting employable people for his company. And right now, with the market the way it is, he's taking literally the bottom of the barrel. All right. So his long-term thought is, well, I want to create a better community, but I want to do it in a way that benefits my business too. So I want to be able to create opportunities for people who are maybe disadvantaged in some way. They're growing up in a bad neighborhood, they have broken, whatever it is. I want to create an opportunities and an environment for these people to become productive members of society. And in so doing, I will increase the pool of people that are employable. See, that's a very specific thing, but it shows you how, if I said to him, you know, and his name is Al, actually, I said, Al, you know, I think these kids really need to leg up. Okay. Well, I think they need to leg up because they're going to be productive members of society and be employable. Oh, well, then you got his attention. There we go. That's an example of how you rephrase what you're doing.
Great. How about tips to engage the board to meet, recruit, and fundraise?
Well, I think there's that word, tips. Ooh. Let me rephrase that to approaches, shall we? And I would say that the approach is that you need some sort of coaching or training that's going to change their perspective a little bit, and let them understand that it's not about money. You know, you get them into a room and you say, we're going to give you some ideas that maybe you haven't thought of, you know, and you do it in a nice way. And I would suggest doing it in a place where they don't normally meet. Because you go to the same room, well, then everybody assumes the same power position. So if you got a couple of real dominant board members, they're going to shut everything down, or they could. So you take them to a place offsite where they normally don't meet. You change up the human dynamics, and we are physical people, and this does make a difference. You know, the shape of the table, the location, all that, it does make a difference. You put them in an environment which none of them are normally at. It levels the playing field. And then you get an opportunity for them to listen to you to do something different. And that's where you usually bring, whether it's me or somebody else, you bring in someone that's going to offer them a different perspective. So, because when you start saying it, oh, we've heard this guy talk before. Oh, yeah, the same old, they're playing the same old tapes in their head. You know, give me an example. When this, one of our, I think it's a half day workshop. It was, we call it the aha moment for a reason. It's called the aha moment. And that is, we had a board of a pretty major social service agency that was being coached, and I was there at the time, and I was watching this, and it was a 4-hour session, and we were in there maybe an hour, and all of a sudden the board chair, who had been the board chair for over a decade, jumps up out of his seat just in the middle of everything, and you're going, what is he going to say? Well, you never know. And you know, and then he just said, now I get this, now I understand this. The light came on for him, and when it did, then he saw it through a whole different lens. And that's really what you try to have to achieve. Because then they're open to you. Then they're open to doing things in a different way. You know, if you want to do something incrementally, you show them, like one thing we did, this is a tip, all right, an organization that had never done this before, you just get the board to make thank you calls. Here, how hard is that? And then you structure it in a way so they don't get off easy. That if you leave a message, they have to give a return phone call. You give the person an opportunity to return and to talk to you. And that particular organization had never really done that before. And there was a call that was made to a first time donor of $200, new person in the community. And because of that call, no money was ever requested or anything. 2 weeks later, they got a check for $20,000 in the mail. Think about that. That can happen.
And that is a perfect place to end because we're right at the top of the hour. So, Larry, I want to thank you so much for all of this thought-provoking content, helping us see things through a different lens. It's so helpful to pull back and look at the bigger picture because it is the bigger picture that makes the difference. So I really appreciate your being here with us today. And I'm sure a bunch of people will reach out to you. I want to share, many of you know that we started our free workshop at Asking Matters yesterday. Don't ask, don't get. It's not too late to be a part of that. It's four live webinars I'm doing, giving you a lot of the basics to help you feel more comfortable and effective as an asker. And you can sign up for that whenever you want and see the recordings. And we'll continue bringing you great fundraising masters throughout the fall and into 2020. So again, Larry, thank you. Best of luck to all of you with your fundraising, and I hope you have a really successful fall. Thanks so much, everyone.